Dana
and Chris,
and we are Bad Queers. If you came out of the closet and got put in a box of stereotypes you don't belong to, then welcome to the Bad Queers Club.
All right, this week in Queer Urban Dictionary, I have restorative justice. Restorative justice repairs the harm caused by crime. When victims, offenders, and community members meet to decide how to do that, the results can be transformational. Mm-hmm. It emphasizes accountability, making amends, and if they are interested, facilitated meetings between victims, offenders, and other persons. My example sentence is, examples of restorative justice include victim assistance, community service, victim offender mediation, peacemaking circles, and family group conferencing. So that is restorative justice, or one of the definitions of it. I'm sure there's a lot of interpretations.
There's many. Look at us. We're deep diving. Even mine kind of gets a little historical.
It does.
Historical here.
Go back with this.
My Queer Urban Dictionary word, well, phrase this week is the pink triangle. I want to try and hit some symbols as well. We haven't hit symbols. We're hitting the slurs and the symbols and all of that whole educational piece. So the pink triangle was used during the Holocaust. Prisoners in Nazi concentration camps were required to wear badges to describe why they were imprisoned, i.e. Jewish people would wear the gold star. And prisoners that Nazis determined as homosexual required them to wear an inverted pink triangle on their chest to identify them as sexual deviants. Not only did they do this to LGBTQ plus folks, they also did this to pedophiles, zoophiles, and sex offenders, which I feel like was a major key in why people try to lump together the LGBTQ plus community and pedophiles and sex offenders. So I want to give a shout out to Matt Bernstein for this info. You can follow him at Matt XIV, which is like Matt 14 with the symbols. But shout out to Matt Bernstein for this info. This sentence just continues on the information. So you might wonder why we still see this symbol in present day. So in 1970, the gay liberation advocates reclaimed the pink triangle to turn it into a symbol of protest, which is why we see it around so often. And also we get to see it because we live in the Bay Area, when during Pride Month, you get to see this giant, like 20-foot triangle that they put up on the hills and they light it up. And apparently it can be seen from like major distances, but they do that every year during Pride Month.
Yeah. Nice. I don't think I knew that they reclaimed this from the Holocaust days. Like I knew the pink triangle, but I didn't know that they reclaimed it from the Holocaust days. So that makes sense.
Right? We be out here reclaiming stuff. We're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a bad queer opinion about that. Maybe that will be mine for today, but it's about the F word and people reclaiming it. So it'll be a question one. Look at me teasing.
Look at this. Little tease. Look at that. This is going to be an interesting conversation, especially with the person that we're bringing on today. Especially with the person who actually, yes, please do it, because this is going to be great. So today we have a special guest. Mm-hmm. Their name is Michaela Berry. They use they, them pronouns, and they are a writer, educator, and creator focused on making and providing spaces in which marginalized voices can be heard and encouraged. Currently, they work as a harm reduction specialist for folks living in supportive housing. They most recently served as the restorative justice coordinator at you see our definitions, for Soul Sisters Leadership Collective, where they manage Circles Not Cells, a restorative approach to conflict, in addition to 8 Circles of Safety, which implements 8 restorative justice healing circles to support young people with their reentry. For the past 4 months, Michaela has also been engaging in restorative justice work with the young men at Horizons Juvenile Detention Center, where the programming is centered on navigating toxic masculinity and LGBTQIA education. Michaela is also a second-year master's student at Columbia School of Social Work. Their goal is to write trauma-informed curriculum to make the classroom a safer and more equitable place for students of color.
Welcome to Michaela. We're happy to have you. You have been so persistent in our IG. That's a great way to put it. No, it's great. It pays off. We were like, we have to have Michaela on, but like we finally
Michaela
was in our DMs. I was like, Chris, I checked the DMs a bit more than you. I was the one that would sit every time Michaela would come in and be like, so what about me? I could talk about this. We could talk about these things, and then would switch to personal accounts.
All that shit.
And I'd be like, oh, hey, Michaela, still here.
Yeah.
Still here.
I think but specifically, we love you. I think the phrase I used was, put me on the podcast, you cowards, if I remember correctly.
That was a direct quote. So if anybody else wants to be on the podcast,
bullying works. But also, you got to have something to say. So like, Michaela, we worked together last year. You were supposed to be an in-person event producer in New York. Then lockdown happened. So you saved so many of our online events last year. We had like over 300 of them, which was just insane. But you are one of our favorite event producers that we had. And again, like last year during lockdown, brought a lot of joy to folks. So happy to have you back. But before we get into any and everything, how are you? How are you doing? How are you doing? You are in a lot of emotionally draining spaces, whether that comes to grad school and other spaces. Like, how are you doing?
Oh my God, grad school, these fucking people. I'm having a fine time at Columbia School of Social Work. It's very draining because a lot of social workers like to just like they analyze everything, you know, because you're supposed to, but it's also like very annoying. Like sometimes people are talking about things in class that like don't matter. And I'm like, please shut up. But it like matters because of the process. And so that's fine. My classes are from 6:20 PM to 10:20 PM on Mondays and Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. Because I also work full time and have 2 part-time jobs. So
casual, extremely casual,
very, mm-hmm. very normal. You know, not at all exhausting. I'm doing okay. I have some flexibility in my next couple of weeks because I'm transitioning in between 2 jobs. So things are okay.
Nice. You know, okay. What do you do to distress or just to, have fun in between all this?
I smoke a lot of weed. Mm-hmm. That's huge for me. I'm excited that it's getting cooler here because I'm a big bath person. I take a lot of baths and call my mom. I'm a big mom. My mom is my best friend. I call her maybe 2 to 3 times a week. So yeah, I talk to her a lot.
But I want to rewind back a little bit since we did start off with school. There was some fun, not so fun times that you had in your last semester or the last year that I feel like in every angle possible, it was the most opposite thing that could have happened for wanting to be one and out person, a person of color within like a social work space. And there was just like gaslighting and arguing and you don't know what you're talking about type thing. Can you like give our listeners a bit of a backstory and tell us how it's going now from that progression?
Sure. So last year was my first year at Columbia, and there's a class that you're supposed to take called Foundations of Social Work. The previous title was Decolonizing Social Work, which has since been removed because social work can't be decolonized. We've talked about it. And so it's supposed to be a class about like anti-Black racism. I took my class 9 a.m. log in on Thursday. I'm the only Black person in the class. I'm like, great. This is going to be so great. And I was fighting for my life probably every week because somebody would say something stupid every week. It was honestly astounding to me that people like had so many consistent stupid things to say. And you know, one of the students was international, so he didn't really understand anti-Black racism, and we butted heads a lot with that. And then that was my one class where I was just like kind of emotionally exhausted the whole time. And then I had another class in my second semester where at the very last class this white guy like told me to told me to fuck off. I told him,
of course he did.
He was like, fuck off. It was my last class of the semester. So I had been drinking and I was like, if I unmute myself, I'm going to say some really mean things. So I just left class. Cause he like told me, I was like, this is rude. And I'm not going to like tolerate this level of disrespect in the classroom. And like, also where is my professor? Like what's going on?
Right. Here? That's what I was about to say. Like who's teaching?
me. I was the one I had taught so many of my classes, I feel like Columbia owes me way more money than I owe them. You know, it's been so much of me, especially because my background is in, like, I work with youth in detention, and, you know, I have a social work background already. So I have a lot of things that I can offer and bring up, and I do. And sometimes I'm like on Monday in one of my classes, I like wasn't paying attention. And then the next slide, like, said my name, it said Mick, and it had my quotes from my like discussion post that my professor wanted the entire class to talk about. And I was like, I wrote that discussion post on my phone, like on my way somewhere. Like, it's just, it's a lot. And it's a lot of, well-meaning, I want to say, white people who, mm-hmm. you know, want to do good, but have a lot of things that they need to resolve and figure out on their own. And it's, as a person of color, I'll be honest, like, extremely exhausting to just like have to go through every week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm like, give me the damn degree at this point.
Right.
But I do have friends in my classes this year. Like, I have people who I know who I can like private message, and like, we have a new game where we try and make each other like laugh so hard we go off camera during class, just to like keep ourselves entertained. And I just right. love that I'm still the class clown and still as disruptive as I was when I was like in elementary school and my teacher had to like move me every week because I just was talking to everybody. Like, I'm still doing that. I'm like private messaging people like, what's your sign? Or like, ooh, what's going on in your background? Just because I'm bored.
Right. How do you balance that of trying to decide whether or not you're going to, you know, help the well-meaning white folk, quote unquote, or basically protect you and say, I'm not the person that had to come in and explain this all. But sometimes then it becomes hard because you're like, ah, how are all of you not seeing it? And all of you are just talking in circles, and I could resolve this right now, but also, no, I need to protect my space. How do you balance between those?
That's a great question. I don't know that I do. I you know, I feel like most of the time I tap in and I'm like, hey, or like, you know, this is what, you know, most of the time I just show up in that way, and don't think about how exhausting it is. I've tried to do that less. I have this new rule where like, I just don't engage with the devil's advocates anymore. Like, that's just mm-hmm. not my ministry. That's not working for me. If you're playing devil's advocate, you can do that and you can deal with that somewhere over there. But also I've been like, I think I said it last year, but I like was like, other white, I was like, white people can call white people out. Like, I was like, y'all can call each other out. Like, maybe you should do that a little bit more. Like, I right. don't know why I'm the one who's always like, hey, excuse me, when you were DMing me in Zoom chat being like, hey, was that okay? Like, if you know it's not okay, like, say something. So that's one of the things. And then I think, yeah, also like, sometimes people just don't want to change their opinions and there's nothing you can do about that. And while that sucks, like, I'm like, oh, well, Yes, that's it. You know, like, if I can't, sorry, I can't change your mind, but I'm not going to like continue to do this effort when it's clear that you're not like welcoming the change or like welcoming the conversation.
Right. Yeah. That's what kind of scares me about the time now, and just like having realizations of like, oh, like, there's a group of white people who like just don't want to get it like at all. Like, they're not even trying and all that. And like, I'm like, all right, I don't have to keep trying to like change their minds. But the group in the middle, like the well-meaning / like unconscious biased folks, are just like exhausting in a different way where I'm like, okay, we're kind of wasting time on trying to get you to just understand like really basic things. So then mm-hmm. that distracts from like, and depletes energy from like actually getting to the issues. Do you feel like temperature check? Like, where are we with that? Like, you are amongst, you know, people who are studying this and are still don't get it. But yeah, like, it is a thing of like, do I deplete my energy trying to turn this around, or what the hell do I do in this situation?
So, fun fact, I actually wrote the School of Social Work's anti-racism curriculum for every new student to do. They had to do an anti-racism training. A 2-day anti-racism training that I co-wrote with someone. It's called Professional Development and Self-Awareness is the name. But it's diversity, equity, and inclusion work. It's DEI work. And, I spent this summer writing that curriculum, based on everything that I didn't receive, from Columbia last year. They should be paying. They really should be paying you.
I stopped. Like, I hope that they start a campaign.
They're paying me something. They're not paying me enough. Mm. You know, they're like, oh, second year students, as opposed to making it like a full time position, which it should be. Mm-hmm. But I spent my summer figuring out what I needed and what I would want other people to know. And we rewrote the entire curriculum based on what had previously existed. And one of the things that we talk about is the difference between being an ally and a co-conspirator. So allies read all the books, allies know about the new Ta-Nehisi Coates book, allies know about, like, have read all the articles, listened to all the podcasts, are subscribed, you know, doing the Patreon thing, listening to 6019 projects. That's an ally, right? They can quote everything. Co-conspirators put their bodies on the line. Co-conspirators, you know, are more active and showing up with their bodies and their privilege. Like the whiteness is like a bank, is what Bettina Love says, you know, and you can just cash out. Like it's an ever never ending like thing. And so we wanted to instill that in white folks to understand like their positionality and their privilege. I will say I am very like inspired by most of my classmates. There is a lot of conversation about abolition and what it means to be complicit in the system as social workers, and you know, the ways that social workers are cops without guns in a lot of situations and a lot of scenarios, which has been really hard for some of these white people to realize, like, what? Yeah. Like, I thought this was a helping profession, you know?
Right.
It really blows some minds, and I'm always like, yeah, this is the thing. But we have some really, like, everyone I feel like who I've been working with more closely, like there's going to be a new wave of social workers coming out that are going to be like different, that aren't going to just kind of play the game or fit into the system. Like there were some disruptors, which is really, really great. And I do believe that there is, social work is by no means perfect. It was founded in white saviorism. So, but there is a lot of great movement in the field and a lot of really great people who are like taking on the work that I like believe in cautiously, you know, cautiously optimistic.
Led by you. I hope you get paid by Columbia, because again, like I'll
like,
go to your page
to you
and,
for that.
Yeah. Like, but I'll go to your page and I'll learn like so much like from your page. Facts. And like, you'll have like your work guides or your study guides and worksheets and everything. And you have a Patreon that we'll definitely need to plug before we go. But what inspired you to go into social work? Like, when did you know, like, this is what I want to do and pursue?
I feel like I am consistently outing myself as a theater major, but I used to major in theater. I did. I have a whole degree in it. So thanks to my debt for theater. Love it. I studied theater, playwriting specifically, and African American studies at Fordham University. The only Black playwright to ever graduate from Fordham randomly.
That's crazy.
In 2018, what? You would think. No, it's you know, white supremacy. Oh, okay. A good time. And so I didn't like making theater within institutions. Like, I was like, this is boring, and I really am not interested in this kind of art. And I had it in my head that I wanted to teach theater at a prison, but I had never done it. And then I had the opportunity to do it as soon as I graduated. And I had this 6-week random residency at Rikers Island and was teaching storytelling to the young women at the Rosie Singer Center with another person. And I had no idea what I was doing, and I was scared. And Rikers is like the worst. Like, when you hear about Rikers, it's like 10 times worse than what you think about, like what you think. Like, I never left without a headache. Like, it was like a crazy, crazy place to work. And I also had no idea what I was doing. I was like, I have a theater degree, and now I'm like in a prison. Like, it was like, it was crazy. But I really, really loved working there. I loved working with the young women there. Their interpretation of storytelling, you know, when I'm so used to like studying it and being with my classmates, it's like, it was so different and so much more vibrant, and just like, I got so much more out of it. And at the end, one of the young women, we were going around, they were saying, you know, everything, things that they liked about, you know, our time together and like whatever, because everything, and every time you do like prison programming, there should be a certificate or something at the end that the participants can like put on their resume or use. So you have to turn it into something that they can like benefit from. Right. So we were like, you know, giving their certificates and whatever. And one of the young women was like, you made it feel like we were on the outside. And I was like, holy shit. Like, no, I talk about it
That's
all the time
so awesome.
Because I don't think I've ever heard, or maybe ever will hear, something that like impacted me as much as that specific sentence did. Because I was like, oh, if I am able to do that in this small way, then I definitely can do it in a bigger way. I was like, oh, I can keep doing this. Like, this is something that I know how to do. And so then I kind of moved into teaching artists work with youth in detention, which was like less arts focused and more, at the time I didn't know the language for it, but more restorative justice focused. And then that just kind of took over. And I realized that if I wanted better access to these populations, I needed a secondary degree. Because as you know, you can get in the door with a bachelor's in theater, but as a social worker, you can actually like walk around without an escort or, you know, whatever.
Right.
And so I applied to Columbia because it's the closest one to my apartment. It was the only school I applied to. I was searching for new jobs and also was applying to grad school. I was like, just like throwing darts at like, you know, my life. Being like, we'll see what sticks. And then I got into Columbia during the pandemic and I was like, well, this feels safe. I was like, well, 2 years of grad school, that feels secure. So I was like, let me go. And so it was less about like, oh, I really want to be a social worker, and more about like, let me figure out what's going on here and like have a security measure. But also the work that I've been doing has been social work, like working with youth in detention for the past 3-4 years is like, I'm well beyond a lot of my peers because of the work and experience that I had. Mm-hmm. So I moved into that and then some other things opened up, and now every Sunday I teach with young men in detention, and I now work with folks who use drugs as a harm reduction specialist. That's my like day job. And then at night I'm in class.
Well, I know you didn't mean to get there, but that's kind of like a beautiful path to it. Like that doesn't happen to a lot of people, like finding their calling that way, but that's like a beautiful path. Like you literally like represented freedom.
And I would like to mention that I dropped out of grad school twice before I went to Columbia. So I got into UT Austin right after I graduated, and I moved to Austin, and my mom met me there to sign my lease and like help me move in. And as soon as I got to Austin, I was like, wow, I hate it here. I was like, no, like the minute I landed, I was like, nope, it's too hot. And then I regret, it's so hot. Texas in August.
I mean, your mom was like, what the fuck?
Summer in New York is a sweaty mess. And you're like, nope, it's too hot.
I was like, it's too hot. I was with my girlfriend at the time. We were doing long distance. That was a mistake. But anyway, so I was like, I miss my girlfriend. And then I got into my Uber to the hotel to meet my mom, and my Uber driver was too friendly. Like, I was like, damn, are they really this friendly? And my plane was late. Like, it was just bad. Yeah. And so I was like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. It was a PhD program, 5 years. So I was like, and it was a performance as public practice. So a theater history degree. I thought I was going to get my PhD and come back and do the Fordham, like, and run the Fordham theater program out of spite, because I didn't have a good time there. You can quote me on that. But I get to Austin and I'm like, I hate it here. And my mom's like, so like, I'm sorry. She's like, that sucks for you, but, we're here and, we're signing your lease the next day. And then the next day we went to get stuff in my apartment. I get a call. It's from USC. They're like, hey, you were the first person on our wait list and for MFA program. And somebody dropped out. Do you want to go to USC? And I had a beer about it. And then I was like, yeah, I do, because I packed all my shit and I moved back home to my childhood bedroom. And I went to USC for 6 weeks, in their MFA program for dramatic writing. And I was like, this also sucks. I don't want to be 26 and be hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt with two degrees in writing.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, so I dropped out of that program and I moved back to New York.
Still a beautiful journey, I'm gonna say. Still pretty cool turning down two big institutions. Like,
I can feel the gray hairs
better that way.
Your parents.
Yeah, your mom probably was like, yo, for real.
All right.
She's like, when I got into Columbia, she was like, you can't drop out of this one. I was like, I know, I know.
This is third time's
she
a charm.
She was like, no, third time's a charm. We are not doing this again. It is no excuses.
That's funny. That is hilarious.
I love this. And even with, so to go back to the jobs that you're doing education around like LGBTQ plus education, but what does that fully entail? Because I can only imagine the discussions that you are having. So is it just like identity based? Are you doing a history based? Is there a bit of sex education in there? What are all of the things that you kind of cover?
Yeah. So the young men that I work with, are between 16 and 19. And we talk a lot about, it's really, it's funny. So the first time that I, went, it was a site visit. Like, I wasn't their teacher yet. I was just like seeing it through. And like, I mentioned that the organization that I work for, I only got as far as saying that we worked with women and non-binary youth before I had to explain what being non-binary was. And then I was explaining that I was non-binary and that I use they, them pronouns. Then one of the kids called me a tranny and I was like, no, let's not. And like, we had to like, you know, go back and unpack that. And I was like, that's not even the right insult for someone of my experience. Like, I was like, and I was trying to explain all of this and it was nothing but just like, they didn't have the language for it. And so then we like discussed it. And then when somebody was like, oh, I don't want to ask my question because it might be offensive. And I was like, nothing you ask me is going to offend me because I know who I am and I know what I'm doing. And I know my shit. And so when that barrier was broken, they were asking really just like honest questions. And so I took that information and took the thing. I was like, oh, toxic masculinity. Like, I need to talk about this with these young men. And I came in and came up with this version of this of a game, kind of, but it was, you know, like, what does LGBTQIA stand for? True or false, there are only two genders, like things that were just kind of, that would poke at the conversation. And then I'd pull out like the gender bread person, the way that I referred to the gender bread person for like two solid weeks. I was like, wait, no, because they're like, wait, there's more than two genders. And I'm like, look, and like, I'm like, your head and your heart, it's different. I got really excited about it. Yeah, so we talk a lot about that. We've been talking a lot about misogyny, and the recent realization or conversation that we've been having is I start by asking them, like, do you think that women are generally afraid of men? And they always go, no, when I know that the answer is yes. Right. You know, like when I know that like walking down the street is terrifying. Mm-hmm. But they're like, no, women aren't afraid. Like, why would women be afraid of men, right? And then I ask them, like, are you more comfortable with gay men or gay women? They're like, oh, gay women, gay men make me uncomfortable. They really don't like, they're homophobic, but it's not because they're homophobic. It's because of fear. It's because of uncertainty. Like, when you don't know about something else, you know, you get really like anxious about it. And I give them a lot of grace because of their circumstance and because of the way that they were raised. Like, they were raised so rigidly within these structures of masculinity that are kind of like, you know, hardened by the fact that most of these boys are gang affiliated, and you know, then they are tossed into the system where it's just these men, and all of those toxicities are just kind of repeated. And what I've noticed is that it's fear and not hatred. It's like, it's fear of, you know, seeing somebody who is able to express themselves in a way that they don't feel like they can. Right. Because that's a big part of it. They're always like, well, I don't know why gay people are so flamboyant. I was like, why does that make you uncomfortable that they're so comfortable being themselves? I see their little wheels turning and I'm like, oh, gotcha.
But they're just like, why am I uncomfortable? What is this?
Yes, I did it, you know? And then I asked them the thing that we've been talking about recently, which is super interesting. You know, are you afraid of men? No. I mean, do you think women are normally afraid of men? No. I'm more comfortable around gay women. Interesting. Okay. Now, your little brother comes out to you as bi. Oh, I'm beating him up. Oh, I'm, you know, oh, he's not allowed to do that shit around me. Oh, you know, that's not cool. That's not cool. Okay. Your little sister comes out as lesbian. Okay. That's better actually. And I was like, why is that better? Cause I don't want her around men. Oh, so you think men are a threat to women then?
That's whoa, cool. Look at that full circle.
You know, I was like, wait for you to get back to it. I was like, ooh, this is going to be good. So good.
I have to, it's kind of the same lesson every week because I have to keep, I'm the only person out of an hour of their weeks, their month, their weeks that like is presenting information that's like, you know, like this, that challenges them and encourages them and like gives them agency and also understand they're not stupid and they're not, you know, it's nothing, like they're just not stupid. And I think people treat these kids like they're stupid all the time. And I come in just like, yeah, what do you got? You know, like, I think we're finally at a point now since I've been there for a couple months where like, they don't try to like fuck with me as much as they used to, or like thwart me in whatever way. Cause they just have realized that that's not going to work. Like I just can't, I'm not fazed. Like whatever they say or come at me, I'm like, all right, like sure. And that's helpful, I think, especially working with young men.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. What are some things that you hope to take from your learnings and see in public schools, or just like how we educate in public schools? Like, is that something you ultimately want to do? Like, where you're creating policies or just programs or programming around, like, how do you handle these situations like that? Like that situation would be approached totally different, obviously, from like a white social worker. But even, yeah, some Black people who don't know how to interact within the community or, you know, from people with different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Generally, people don't know how to deal with young people, specifically like young adults. Like, I'm thinking about, like, I've been working with like teenagers, Black teenagers, mm-hmm. Since I was a teenager, like since I was 19, I've been like mentoring and doing things. Like, so for 6 years now, I've just been working with them, and they're just like, talked down to and are never asked what they want. They're never asked, like, they're never given any agency. It's always like, you're doing this and then you're going to do this and then you're going to do this. And like, that doesn't work for a lot mm-hmm. of people. And that doesn't work for a lot of learners. And I think that what folks need to understand is that these people are people with complex thoughts who, like, yes, don't, you know, think the world revolves around them, because a lot of teenagers do. And like everything, mm-hmm. I think the other thing is, like, when you're a teenager, like, this is what I've had to talk about in restorative justice work, is like, when you're a teenager, everything is the biggest fucking deal. Like, right. Like, everything you do is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And you have to understand that and like make sure, like, that's valid, you know, like, yeah. Your life is only this many experiences. So of course this is mm-hmm. really big for you. I think a lot of times adults forget that how they were when they were kids, and that really influences the way that they treat kids. Because I remember being 18, 17, 16, 15. I was freaked out. I was freaking out all the time about everything. But I also thought that I had, like, I also didn't want somebody to tell me what I was doing, you know? Yeah. I think just understanding that balance and that nuance is something that is missing. And what I actually want to do is get my PhD. Like, the world is ending. I like hate it. I hate how much I love school. Like, I really wish I didn't love it as much, but I literally love it.
Right.
And so I'm looking, there's a specific program at NYU that's the sociology of education. And I want to look at how youth education programs in juvenile detention facilities can reduce recidivism rates. So how we can create better structures and environments for learning for youth who are in transitional housing, who are, you know, in systems involved, so that they can continue their education. Because, like, that's a huge thing that I'm dealing with right now with the boys that I'm working with, is them being like, you know, some of them are 16, 17 and could go back to school, but don't feel comfortable with it because of the gaps in their education that they have had because they've been locked up. And I mean, ideally, yes, none of these kids would be locked up, but like, in the meantime, I can examine these things and figure out how we can plug up those holes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Man, you're the type of person that we need for all of the future youth, especially in the areas where, yes, there's work being done to make it better, but there needs to be that more diverse voice, and not even just like in terms of like your identity, but also like the way that we think has to move outside of, you know, just like the classic social workers that we see that are like the nice, cute white ladies that are going to come in and do this. Like, we need to have younger, bolder, more like different thoughts that come through. And I think you're going to be like paving the way for it, which is awesome to see. So love the work that you're doing and love all the things. But of course, we couldn't just come in here and talk to you about all of the amazing work that you're going to do, because we also just need to hear about your dating life and just get a little personal and just hear how things are and just hear how they're going. So what's life like? Are you in a relationship? Are you playing the field? What's going on?
I am not in a relationship, but there are currently three beautiful women over the age of 30 who are competing for my attention.
Okay.
Plus
group.
So
nice.
I will say that.
Best way to describe just a little friendly competition in New York. It's cool.
Of those three, there's one who I am extremely into. Like, we went on the best first date ever last week. Yeah, it was just like the best first date ever. Like, she was just super. She's a friend of a friend. She's gorgeous. She's taller than me. Love that. Mm-hmm. I'm five. Should I lie? I'm gonna lie. I'm 5'10".
I was like, don't you lie. You tell us.
I'm 5'10". and we went to Brooklyn Museum, and then we got drinks, and then we went like dancing, and then I walked her home, and it was just like very sweet, and like the conversation was effortless, and like she's really beautiful, mm-hmm. and we just had a really nice time.
Did you know her before this?
I did.
She's a friend of a friend. Okay. She's so was she like, on your radar for a while where it was just like, well, you know, we'll see if it happens. It happens.
Or did a friend tap in and be like, hey, nudge, nudge, like, wink, wink.
We like met on Memorial Day. Is that the one that's early? Is that the one that like marks summer and then Labor Day ends summer? Is that true?
Memorial Day.
I don't know. It's not like,
I mean, for the better part of, yes.
Sure. Yes. We met on at a Memorial Day like rooftop party where I was extremely messy and made out with many people that I forgot about until my friend the next day was like, hee-hee, guess what you did? and then we hadn't seen each other in a while. And then in perhaps one of the gayest nights of my life, it was an L-word screening at Henrietta Hudson's. What are their names? I know their character names. I'm so bad at that. Shane and Alice, they were there.
Yes.
Okay. So it was very much, very much gay, very much queer. The reason we were going is because in that specific episode, my friend Deja at Deja Bilardo, my friend Deja's art was featured in the scene where Bette is like looking around at the art show. And so Deja had also like done some art at, done some art at Henrietta Hudson's. And so she invited all of her friends out to like support and like, you know, scream when her art came on the stage. And like, I'm everyone's hype man. And they also mistakenly were handing out those karaoke mics. And they shouldn't have given me one, but I actually asked for one. I was like, can I have one? And my friends were like, no. And I was like, and then I was going around like yelling, being like, my friend's art is coming up in 28 minutes. And I was like interviewing people. It was really, really fun.
But anyway, timestamp.
Yeah, it was great. I was like, in 28 minutes. And then that night I actually wound up getting so drunk that both my heels broke and I lost the microphone. It's fine though.
Did they break at the same time or just?
No. Okay. They didn't. The one broke off and I think my drunk ass was like, let's see if the other one's going to break off. And then I got in an Uber and was like, let me go home. But she was there. she was there. And it was funny because when we went on the date, she was like, I wasn't sure you were into me. And I was like, oh yeah. Cause like I was flirting with everyone. Cause I was like, what I do. And I was like, no, yeah, I'm definitely into you. And then we went on this like amazing first date. And then we had a second date. She got me flowers.
Oh, wow.
And we're hanging out again tomorrow. We're getting dinner and then going to meet some of my friends. So yeah, the other two are on the back burner.
Okay.
Do they know they're on the back burner or is this the way that they're going to find out?
I think so.
I think so. Okay. Yep.
We're going to find out when you get some texts and be like, listening.
That is an answer, though.
I just need to check because my calendar said that we didn't go out on this date by the time this did, but they don't know when we recorded, so it's fine.
Well, everybody who I'm seeing knows that it's casual. Like, I'm not dating anyone. I'm just casually seeing people.
How is that conversation now as a old, washed, married person with this is going to be casual? Like, is it saying like, no, I'm actively going to date other people. I hope that like you understand that's what I mean by casual. Like, do you have to spell it out like that? Or it's just like, you get that they're on the same page and like-minded.
Maybe I should be setting these boundaries better, but I just operate under that. Like, I don't really care what you do when you're not with me, unless we decide that we care about what each other does. Like, unless that conversation comes up, you know, like, and I haven't had that, like, I want to be with you or only you, or are you dating? And if they asked me if I was dating other people, I would say I would be honest about it. But like, I don't care if they're dating other people. I've like really realized that. Like, if you, well, except for this person that I'm seeing tomorrow, I know that she's not. So yeah, I mean, honestly, no, let me not say that.
I was tempted. I was like, honestly, tell us about it.
No, let me not.
I love this. Does your have, well, in general, has this person met your cat and or does your cat have an impact on your dating life?
This person has not met my cat, but I have met her dog and I love her dog. It's like chillest, sweetest dog. She's really so cute. And I'm not like a huge dog person, but this dog is like super chill. I'm looking at Samantha Nicki Minaj right now. she has been on one, that's her name, full government name. She has a gold chain and she's perfect. And yeah, she is really important. And when people meet her, like, she's like, she loves other people. She hates kids. My neighbor is 3 and comes in sometimes to like hang out, and Sammy hisses and like hates her. And she always wants to come in to like pet the cat. And I feel so bad for both of them, because I like want to hang out with my neighbor, but also like Sammy hates her. But she likes other people. And, actually, this is funny. When people come over, and I don't know if I'm going to share, it's fine. I do this funny thing whenever people who come over for like the second time, like if we're dating or sleeping together, or even if they're a friend, like this is just what I do and they think they're special. I always yell to my cat when I like come into my apartment. I'm like, oh, your friend's here, to like be like, oh, like, you know, Sammy, your friend's here, because she's friends with everyone. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if people think that I say that for just them, because I don't. I say it for everyone. I'll just set the record straight right there.
Secret's out.
I say it for everyone. The secret is out. But that's important, because she runs my life, and she's really been on one like lately, like as of late. I got her kitty CBD, because I'm bougie.
I have CBD for my dog.
I love my cat because,
yeah, I mean, you should. But your cat might not be so hype. Like, my dog's like, yeah, Oakland's crazy. So he needs to.
He has his moments.
Calm down.
But yeah. Now that I'm about to travel, I might have to invest and become a bougie cat.
It's great.
It's been good for her. It's been good for her.
Yeah. I love when he's a little too high. He's just a delight. He'll just come in and just be like, hey, and just fall out where he is. And just kind of like, his reactions are slower. It's just, it's a wonderful sight and all that. So, well, you are dating. So we were going to ask a LA versus New York dating thing, but I guess you could tell us what has been your experience dating in LA, maybe a little bit, in versus New York.
Listen, people are always like, you're from LA and you don't know how to drive. I don't know how to drive. Okay. I'm gay.
Well, I mean, you moved to the number one city that you don't need to drive. Yeah. And so listen, you're good.
I failed my driver's test when I was like 18 because I cut someone off, and then I honked at them because I have road rage. And I remember it was really funny because the instructor was like, okay, pull over. And I was like, oh, did I pass? And he was like, get in the passenger seat. And I was like, okay. And then
like,
I moved.
Okay, share.
Fine. And then I moved to New York. So I didn't drive. So in New York, I'm just limited because I don't drive. And also, in LA, I'm just limited because I don't drive. And I can just hop on the subway when I'm in New York. And also, I don't know, I don't love LA. Don't tell. It is always going to be where I am from and where my mother and grandmother live, but I very much consider New York home. LA is
broad. Do you want to stay there? Like, do you want New York to be your permanent home? You can always move.
I mean, if I'm getting my PhD, that's kind of like, I'm going to be here for at least 10 more years, probably. Right. So I don't see myself living anywhere else at the moment. So I probably will stay here for a minute, but yeah, I definitely prefer dating in New York than dating in LA.
I can see that. Yeah. LA really, I mean, I don't think anybody's ever come in here and said like LA is that.
Like, so, I'm picking up, putting down, unless it's like a gay man. I feel like that's where it's thriving for them.
Yeah. Makes sense.
I feel like it's much
better.
Just
put that all together today, just right now. Yep. They sure do. They sure do.
We just kept it live.
We solved that, all three of us.
Just right now, live and in person.
Solved I live. That.
Well, Chris, do you have any other relationship questions? Because otherwise, we're going to move off.
I don't. Well, perfect. I don't. I am rooting for
the number
the
one.
The person who's in number one.
The number one. rooting for that person. Beautiful date that you go on tomorrow. Yeah. All the things.
I hope Sammy's okay with this person. Mm-hmm. Like, it just... Yeah, hopefully
I'm gonna tell her to not listen to this for a minute.
You're gonna wait to see how it goes, and then
and then I'll be like, oh, by the way,
like you could have had if it goes wrong, you could be like, you could have had something good. I talked nice about you and everything, and then if it goes great, be like, look, I was already talking about you, like,
So it's a win-win for me.
Yeah,
yeah.
You can't go wrong. You can't go wrong. Well, let's go ahead and make the smooth transition over to our bad queer opinions, because what type of bad queers will we be if we didn't have unpopular queer opinions? Now, Michaela, we know that you know how this works. And we know that you just have a drop down list of great opinions. So Chris and I are going to go ahead and go first as you marinate on which one you feel like sharing to the world. Mm-hmm. And I know that Chris has a question, so I'll go ahead and generally state mine first. Mm-hmm. This has been happening, but I feel like I've been seeing it more often lately where we're having that crossover between like the general, as you were saying, between the ally and the co-conspirator, where it's like the ally is just like, why do we even see color? We shouldn't see mm-hmm. color. Where we're starting to do that even more so in the LGBTQ plus community, being like, especially with the more inclusive pride flags and stuff. So I just need people to stop stating that we shouldn't put race to the pride flag. I think we just need to leave it alone, because all of those people who are saying it don't know the history. They don't understand who the leaders were in the LGBTQ plus community, why they were the ones that paved our rights, which hint, hint, nudge, nudge, it was Black trans women. So this is why I was like, and they don't understand the fact that it's like, sometimes you do need to make such a clear statement so that people go and do the research and understand what the history is. But anybody who's in the LGBTQ plus community specifically, who also is just like, why do we keep making it about race? You're just as bad as the Karens and Chads of the world that say that they don't see color. And that is my bad queer opinion for the week.
Yeah. If we have to deal with race for our entire lives, they are absolutely going to as well. Like, it's races in everything. Like, it is touched every part of society. It still does. Like, it is a part of everything. So
I'm like, look at the border.
It shouldn't even
right
be
now.
A conversation. So
I was like, look at the border, look at the people, look at the systems that are failing because we are in a pandemic, and now it's all being highlighted to show how extra fucked up it is. Because before it was just like a casual fucked upness, and now everybody's realizing, like, oh, we're in danger. Like, that's what I feel like they're doing. Just full that. So that is my bad queer opinion for the week. Chris.
All right.
What is your question?
Yeah, I have a bad queer question. Seen it before. I don't think this is anything new, but wanted to talk about, can we reclaim the F word? And I'll say in my experience, like, I mean, it was always a derogatory term growing up. I've heard queer people use it lovingly. And I might have used it a couple times lovingly, queer to queer. So I would say, I mean, it's not impossible. Like, I say the N-word. I know everybody has their opinions on that, and I respect it. I think when used lovingly, sure. I don't really have a problem. Like, if I heard a queer person call another queer person the F-word, but I'm also not out there policing it. I've never had a personal experience being called the F word, and, you know, it'd be a negative situation. So I can understand people who don't want to use it, but can we? Sure. I mean, we reclaim words all the time. But I don't know. I don't know if it'll have like wide adoption or anything, but yeah. What do y'all think? Can we reclaim the F word? Is it a no-no? Yeah.
I feel like I've definitely queer to queer, like, used it. But I also know that that's a slur that didn't necessarily target people with like my experience. Like, I know typically that's a thing that like gay men get called. So I also don't know if it's like mine to use sometimes, although I do.
Yeah. I do use it sparingly. Like, I don't, like, it's nothing I bring out if it does come out. It's like, it wasn't for me, so I can't really say, no, we're taking it
right
back. So
yeah. I feel like I never say it. I don't feel like this is anything. Like, I feel like the only time I do it is in like an educational context.
Yeah.
You're like, wait, why is this word so bad? And then I
didn't even say it here. Like, I'm not used to just saying it.
We haven't even used it as a definition term yet.
We haven't.
Rock, paper, scissors. Who's going to do it next time?
Right.
But yeah, right. I mean, I feel like a queer to queer is one thing in that reclaiming. I don't think that one's made such a widespread comeback just yet. I don't think people are ready to jump on that train 100%, but I feel like, yeah, it's definitely in like those friendship groups. But I also feel like it just depends on like where you are and how many gay men surround you.
Yeah.
I feel like that's where.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair. All right. Yeah.
That's where I think of it. Yeah. So that would be there's potential. I like the way that you put it, where it's like, there is potential that we could reclaim.
Good.
But is
yeah,
that the first,
I'll let them
is
lead
that on the top of the list? Probably not.
Nah.
Probably not.
Mm-mm. Nah. Michaela, what's your back queer opinion?
My bad queer opinion is, just because you are a member of the Alphabet Mafia does not mean that you are not white first. I have seen a lot of, specifically in the trans spaces, there have been a lot of white non-binary folks and white trans folks who are taking up a lot of space. At the direct detriment of Black trans women, who are always going to be at the front of this and always going to be the ones that we need to be uplifting the most, and supporting the most. And I have seen a lot of white queer people, try to oppress an Olympics their way into feeling like their identity as a queer person is the exact, holds the exact same weight as the identity of Black folks. And you're always going to be white first, and you are literally, you are always going to be white first, and that's going to always mean more. Like, you are always going to have more power because of that. And you're going to have to deal with it, you know, like grapple with that, and think about what that means in terms of your positionality in within the movement, within, you know, within this queer umbrella, because you're always going to be white first.
Well said. Yeah,
I feel like a lot of people, I was going to ask about the oppression Olympics debates that probably happen in those spaces, and you probably see them, because the amount of variety of personalities that happen in New York and probably in those spaces too must be a balance of like, huh, and absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
Like, between those two reactions where it's just like, huh, where do you come off? But like, stop.
Yeah.
Stop. And I don't know if you have any like off the top of your head, but what are some of like the phrases that have just like you've heard when they go into the oppression Olympics debates?
Okay. Well, people like to, and this is not me saying that you being neurodivergent is not, you know, something that you can be oppressed by, but people who lead with that, like lead with disability or lead with their marginalized identity that isn't like, you know, visible, I think is one, you know, is like, well, you know, as somebody with, and as some, or as somebody who, and they're like, I understand what you're saying, you know, or like, I resonate with that because as a, and then they posit a, you know, an identity that doesn't have the same weight as the fact that I could be literally murdered, like hate crimes, just by stepping out of my apartment. And so, and like not not understanding that, I think is a big thing that I've heard a lot, or like people who I've been paying a lot of attention to actually in my classes. I've started to just time people to see how long they talk, just to like see, you know, just to, and like the white women, they always like twice, three times as long as the people of color. They just, and they find ways to, people, you know, it's interesting in these conversations, what I feel like people do is they find ways to just like relate to you, but only so that they can like connect to their own trauma and like kind of like trauma dump on our class or in our study group or like whatever for like a little bit. And then they're done and it's been like 5 minutes and no point has been made. And everyone's like, yeah, sure. Okay. And so I see that a lot, and I've gotten to timing people, and just be, I don't know, just note to white people, be aware of the space you take up.
I'm sorry. That is just so funny to me. You
no, I literally,
do you like hold it? I wish you would just hold it and like face your phone to the screen and just like start it and just sit there and look directly at them through the Zoom and just hold it. And then, oh no, you're still going.
I'm timing you.
Yeah. That is, I can only imagine if somebody did a study on that, what the results would be. So.
Well, we have this framework, this beautiful framework happening already. So love the work that you do. We've made it to the end of the show. This has been so great already. Like, how did we even get here? But we've learned so much and heard so many things. And I hope that a lot of people have learned about the work that's happening. We're going to make sure to give you the point at the end to share where everybody can find you and what like things they should be paying attention to. I feel like that's something that we should put out there as well. So we're going to move on to our shout outs because we would never leave our show without giving a shout out to our faves. So this week, my shout out goes to 7,000 Coils. And it is a Black-owned, femme-led indie record label. And I just came across them because I get, like, random music on my, like, pop-up page on Instagram. And it was great. Mm. And they describe themselves as a sonic nexus of queerness and wellness.
Mm. Sonic and nexus together. Just, you know? I like that.
It's just, it's a good flow. I love it. And they just, like, they just got started. I think they only have, like, 2 posts on their page right now, but I can only imagine the things that they're about to grow into. So you can follow them on Instagram at 7000, literally 7000, Coils, COILS, and give them some love. Chris.
Nice. My shout out is to Alicia Goku, a queer cannabis enthusiast and rapper, self-proclaimed the weed princess. I love following Alicia and seeing her relationship and just also what she's smoking, because it's just like she's living that queer cannabis influencer life where it's just like, wow, I am just happy to see somebody getting paid, somebody Black being paid to smoke. And her music is awesome. So follow Alicia on IG at AliciaGoku_. We'll have that in the description.
All right, Michaela.
All right.
I want to shout out, they're known, but I do want to shout them out because they're doing me a huge solid and providing us with some harm reduction tools for an event that I'm going to be hosting soon. Blue Stockings, in New York, queer owned bookstore. I've got some amazing books from them, that I haven't been able to find in other places. They do Narcan trainings, every Saturday at 6. Everyone should be Narcan trained. Takes like 5 seconds. Google Narcan training your area. That's my harm reduction hottie tip of the day. Everybody should be Narcan trained. And I really, really just, they provide a lot of space for queer folks. I am hosting with a couple of friends an event called Mask for Mask, M-A-S-K for Mask. I came up with the title. But it's going to be a fundraiser October 17th for Lishriata, which is an organization that does mutual aid for sex workers across the United States who have been affected by the pandemic. And we're going to raise a shit ton of money for them and drink and have a DJ and party, and there's a bunch of things to raffle. It'll be really fun if you're in New York, October 17th. You can find all this information on my Instagram, which is Mikaela.mp3, MIKAELA.mp3, like a song, which also has the link to my Patreon, which is patreon.com/Mick, M-I-K-A, Barry. I have study guides and education tools and guided meditations and all sorts of fun stuff on there. Yeah, that's all my self-promo.
We love it.
We love it.
I like your accountability Mad Libs that you made.
Thank you. Really I'm dropping 3 more of them in October. So
yes. Y'all check that out.
Stay tuned.
And support them. Like, sign up for the Patreon. Sign up to become a Patreon or patron. One of them. and follow them again. One of them. You Google it, you know.
Yeah, just go over there and sign up.
Yeah. Michaela, you've done all of your plugs. Is there anything else you want to close with, or even the Narcan tip was great. But anything you want to close with before we say goodbye?
I want to hone in on the Narcan thing. It's really, really easy to get trained. And the reason that you should do it is because it reverses, opioid overdoses. I'm getting in my like harm reduction mode half for a second, but
yes.
There have been, 2 recent overdoses in Bushwick actually, that have been reversed because people had Narcan on them. Be really, really careful if you are taking drugs to test. Use fentanyl test strips. You can buy them in a number of different places. Literally, if you just Google buy fentanyl test strips, you'll be able to find them. I also have all that information on my Instagram for where you can buy them. You should test every drug that you're taking because fentanyl is being found in drugs increasingly, and that shit is really scary and can kill you. And I'm never going to tell you to not do drugs, but I am going to ask that you do them safely.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I hope they legalize drugs soon. Or at some point, so they could test this. But that's another day.
But until then, take matters into your own hand. Test your shit. Have Narcan on you. Be safe.
Test your shit.
Right.
That is it. Michaela, thank you so much for coming on the show and bullying your way on here.
Yeah, I was about to say, thanks for bullying.
I appreciate that so much.
No,
this is when you can bully for good.
Bullying works.
We'll take
bullying it. Does work. You got to bully your way back, and we talk sometime next year or something and see what's going and check in and all that. See what you're about to say, see how school's going and all that, and just talk about screenshots that you have. So your screenshots are so funny.
That's, we're just going to do the whole episode of the screenshots.
Yeah. Love it. Explain your feelings. Explain this. All right, Michaela, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see y'all next week.
Thanks for having me, y'all.
This podcast was brought to you by the Her app, the largest LGBTQ+ dating and community app for women, trans, and non-binary folks. Be sure to download the app in the Apple Store or Google Play Store.
Shout out to Sienna Liggins for our amazing soundtrack, and Cesar for making us sound like we know what we're doing.
It's me again. Can we talk about things? I'm so sorry that I'm coming.